Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Peggy Guggenheim was never what she was supposed to be, the rich heiress doing what heiresses do. The demure woman in a man's world. As World War II turned Europe to ashes, she gathered art and artists that other art patrons sneered at and that the Nazis wanted destroyed, and she saved them. Often mocked, often taken advantage of in her own lifetime, she stands today as maybe the heroine of modern art. This hour on Point, Peggy Guggenheim. You can join us on air or online. Are you a modern art lover or hater? Have you been to the Guggenheim Museum in New York City? How would you describe what it looks like to someone who has never seen it? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Francine Prose, novelist and literary critic. Her new book is called Peggy Guggenheim, The Shock of the Modern. And you will find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Francine, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here.
So one of the most influential patrons of the arts of the 20th century and the black sheep of the Guggenheim dynasty. Describe Peggy Guggenheim.
Well, she did come from a dynasty. She came from a very, very wealthy Jewish family in New York, which was very proper and very traditional. And she was raised to be the perfect wife, to know the perfect kind of silverware to have and how to manage the servants in the mansion. And right from very early on, it was clear to her that she didn't want to be that person. So after a certain amount of floundering around, she got a job in a bookstore that some people she knew ran, and she began to meet artists that way. And pretty soon she left for Paris. This was in the 20s, and got married and began to meet all the artists who were working in Paris then. And by the time she divorced from her husband, had two children, was living in the British countryside with another lover who was a writer. And after his death, she decided she wanted to do something with her life apart from basically following around the men whom she'd been following. And she decided to either have a publishing house or an art gallery. And the publishing house seemed too complicated and expensive, so she opened an art gallery in London, and that was the beginning of her career as a collector and gallerist.
Yeah. And what was it about her intuition for art and artistic talent?
Well, she liked things that were very outrageous at the time. I mean, now when we look back, because we're so used to them, I think it's hard for us to understand how extraordinary and unusual abstract art seemed at that point. But one of the stories I think that makes it clear was that just before the war broke out, she'd amassed this fantastic collection because many of the artists needed and wanted to leave Europe. And they were worried about, particularly in Paris, where everyone knew that the Germans were going to invade, they were worried about what was going to happen to their work. So she went around. She said that she was on a mission to buy a work of art a day. Mm. So for several months, she did that. She went around and bought a work of art a day, and she bought works from Brancusi and Arp and Dali and so forth. Mm. When she wanted some place to leave the collection or to shelter the collection when the war was breaking out, she asked the Louvre. And the Louvre, because they had a huge storage facility where they were sheltering their own art, and the Louvre said, well, the art she'd collected wasn't worth saving, wasn't worth preserving.
Here is Peggy Guggenheim speaking to a biographer, Jacqueline Bograd, in 1978 or 79, explaining how she raced to gather up all the modern art she could before the Nazis invaded Paris.
During the first winter of the war, I tried to buy one painting a day.
How did you go about doing that?
Well, I had friends in Paris, Madame van Doesburg, who was my best friend for years and years. And I had a friend who was a sort of art dealer called Howard Putzel. And I had Marcel Duchamp, who introduced me to artists. So between these three people, and went around on my own and bought things.
Winner. went around on her own and bought things. Word spread in artist circles that the American heiress Peggy Guggenheim was trying to buy up works of art and smuggle them out of Europe before the Nazis destroyed them. Sounds like the telephone rang off the hook.
People telephoned me all day long and even came to my house in the morning and brought me pictures in bed. And actually, the only one I literally bought in bed was this little dolly.
She was quite a character, buying these paintings in bed. But tell us how it worked, the logistics of this.
Well, she went around to the various artist studios, mostly guided by, as she said, Howard Putzel and Nellie von Doesburg. And but she knew these artists already, so and she knew which works she wanted. So, for example, she really wanted Brancusi's extraordinarily beautiful Bird in Space, and she bargained for it, and he wasn't willing to let it go for the price she wanted. And finally, they worked out some deal based on currency exchange, I think. And she describes in her memoir Brancusi weeping as he let her have Bird in Space. But the fact was that had she not bought it, it's not clear what would have happened to it because so much of that art was lost and pirated and so forth.
Here's biographer Jacqueline Bogart again during her recorded interviews with Peggy Guggenheim, marveling that a Jewish woman would dare stay in Paris as the Nazis approached, scooping up degenerate art that Nazis wanted to destroy and smuggling it out of the country.
You could have wound up in a concentration camp.
Yes. Yes, I know that.
Were you ever afraid you'd be captured by the Germans?
No. It wasn't my nature to be afraid.
She just barely escaped Paris with her stash, Francine.
Yeah, she had been stockpiling gasoline on her patio, and she had a car. So she and her friend Nellie just filled the car with gas and headed. Actually, they headed to the east because her ex-husband Lawrence Vale was in a chateau there. So had they gone due south like everyone else, it might not have been so easy, but they managed to evade. And also she was completely confident. I mean, as she said, it really seems never to have occurred to her that something terrible could have happened.
And this art collection, which started as a sort of mixed bag of paintings, today is worth, what, billions of dollars?
Yeah, and it's extraordinary. I mean, I went to Venice, where most of her collection still is housed, and you just go from room to room looking at one masterpiece after another, and, you know, the amazing Jackson Pollocks and the Picassos and the Arps and the Legers. You just can't believe that one woman achieved so much. Mm.
She got to New York, set up an art studio, produced a new kind of art and with her flair, which we'll get to later on in the program. But first, give us a little background, Francine, on Peggy Guggenheim, this very colorful family she came from. Actually started as immigrant peddlers, right? Selling door to door?
Yeah, they came from a German-speaking part of Switzerland. And they did become peddlers, and then they invented, one of her relatives invented, a machine for smelting ore. So they went into the mining business, and they began to buy up mines in this country and in South America. And they figured out how to get the ore out of mines that had been defunct for because they couldn't be mined. So she, so that was her father's family, the Guggenheims. And then her mother's family, the Seligmans, were in banking. And they looked down on the Guggenheims because mining was so déclassé compared to banking, which was a respectable profession. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, between the two families, they had amassed quite a fortune. Although her father managed to spend quite a bit of that fortune on failed business ventures of one sort or another. He wanted to build an elevator in the Eiffel Tower, for example, and somehow that didn't work out.
Well, he went down with the Titanic,
yeah.
Tell us that story.
Well, he was he wanted to come home for Peggy's sister's birthday, and he was a kind of a rake. He had many girlfriends and mistresses and so forth, so it's unclear whether or not he was with his mistress on the Titanic. But nonetheless, it was reported that he, in his evening dress, helped women and children to get onto the lifeboats and then went down with the ship.
Here's some sound. Actress Mercedes Ruehl portrayed Peggy Guggenheim in a one-woman play called Women Before a Glass. Here she tries to get at the heart of what drove Peggy.
Playing Peggy Guggenheim, I got hooked on something mysterious about her, something enigmatic, that to this day I don't entirely understand. She had this hunger, which is about life, pulling against this undertow of unbeatable sadness. So her sexual life was her way of connecting, humanly connecting.
Her relationships and affairs with men were legendary, were they not, Francine?
Yeah, she had quite a lot. I mean, she boasted about having had hundreds of lovers, and among them were some very famous men. I mean, Samuel Beckett, for example, and Max Ernst, for another, and the list went on and on. I mean, of course, the fact that she was so often called promiscuous and so forth, I don't think that was a word that would have been or would be applied to a man in the same situation. I mean, men are generally admired when they have that many lovers, but Peggy was quite put down for it. But she did have a kind of open spirit about it and this kind of willingness. She liked to be in love. She liked to be around men whom she admired. And at least at the beginning of her life, she was one of those women who felt that most of their education came from men, from the men she was involved with. So she was constantly educating herself in the middle of having these mostly disastrous affairs.
Mm. Back to the art, she seemed at first sort of an unsophisticated, maybe naive about her artistic intelligence. She completely, she was either self-taught or taught by those men that were around her, right?
Well, she was very good at finding advisors who were very helpful. There was Howard Putzel again and Herbert Reed, the British art critic and art historian, and her friend Nelly and so forth. I mean, when she first saw Picasso, this was already by the time she'd come to New York and opened, Jackson Pollock, opened Art of the Century, she kind of didn't get it. And Mondrian was there, and Mondrian said, "This is the most important thing. You have to look at this work." And she came around. But I also think that she's been underestimated. I mean, I think, yes, a lot of things got done by her advisors, but she also had a great eye herself.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about heiress, art patron, and outsider Peggy Guggenheim, who it's been said was such an original that she was her own greatest creation. You can join the conversation. What do you make of her, this thoroughly modern, uninhibited woman? What's your question about her remarkable life? My guest this hour, Francine Prose, author of Peggy Guggenheim, The Shock of the Modern. And I'd like to introduce now the woman who made the documentary that we've been hearing excerpts from this hour. Lisa Imordino Vreeland joins us from New York. She's a documentary filmmaker. She's just out with a new documentary called Peggy Guggenheim, Art Addict. The film opens tomorrow in New York and nationally on Friday. You can find a link to the trailer on our website, onpointradio.org. Lisa, so glad to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much. And it's so nice to be here with Francine.
Well, it's wonderful to have you both. Tell us about these audio tapes that you found. They were thought to be long lost. How did you find them?
Well, it was really exciting because in the process of making the film, we had decided to option Jackie Bogard Weld's book, Peggy, the Wayward Guggenheim. And, you know, when you option a book, it doesn't necessarily mean that the author has to open up all of her research to you. And she was incredibly generous and did that. And she kept talking about these tapes that she could not find. She knew she had them, but she just wasn't aware where they were. And it was a process of me being in her house and talking to her. And then one day I said, you know, do you have a basement? And off I went to the basement with real curiosity, and I found them in the last box I looked in, which is quite amazing.
It is amazing. Here's some more sound from those tapes. Here's Peggy Guggenheim comparing great artists to their great works of art.
Do you think that great artists are great people, necessarily?
They're certainly much more interesting than people who aren't intellectual, who aren't interested in the arts, who aren't creative. They're certainly more interesting than business people.
But do they measure up or do they equal their own work?
Sometimes they're disappointing, but sometimes they're even better than their work. When one meets artists, they turn out to be quite different to what one expects.
She says in those audio tapes that she was the midwife to modern art, Lisa, right? She, and a self-described art addict. She couldn't help herself, Lisa.
Exactly. She certainly was. And I think, you know, what's really interesting is that because of her personality, she had this openness to take in not only these artists, but the art movements that were going on. And it's a very kind of peculiar way for a woman at that time to be. And I think Francine could agree to this. But she had this very modern approach to life. And because of that, she could take this all in. And in a funny way, you know, her role and stature in modern art and in art history has been underplayed in a certain sense. And I think that all of these, you know, the film, the book, it's going to really change that. And her role just becomes more important every day.
How would you describe her contribution to modern art, Lisa?
Well, you know what's interesting is that there are not that many historical figures, if you look at it, who have played such an important role in so many different cities, because she had a role in modern art and how it played out in London in 1938 and 39. In Paris, she was saving art and artists. And then she comes to New York and opens up Art of the Century. And this is when, and this becomes a center of the exiled artists and these younger artists who are in New York, it's the beginning of abstract expressionism, but she helps them think in a different way, and the subconscious begins to play a role. And out of that, the abstract expression movement actually develops. And then she arrives to Italy, to Venice in 1947, and she plays a fundamental role with even the Italian artists who start to see paintings that they had never seen before, and they start to think also in a very new way.
We talk about her very modern approach to life, her moxie, her pluck, what she did in Paris, saving a painting a day, getting out of there barely with these extraordinary works of art. John online has this question. Many other buyers of art in the wake of World War II have been subject to scorn or repercussions for buying art and taking advantage of desperate sellers. Did she, Lisa?
You know, I don't think she was taking advantage of desperate sellers in any way. And this question has been posed to me before. And, you know, I think that she had a real vision when she decided she had a métier in life. And this métier was to build a collection to share with the world. She had her list, and she had her curiosity. And yes, she also had advisors. She wanted to build a collection. And frankly, the prices for art back then, you could buy a painting for $60. And, you know, perhaps she asked, I think anybody would rightfully ask, can I get it for less? But I do not see this at all as taking advantage. I see this really as aiding all these artists who needed it.
So many callers here. Let's get to Harris first in Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Harris. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. A pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I was going to give my sort of anecdotal experience that I had with Miss Guggenheim. Back in 1979, I was over in Italy studying and decided Venice was one of the places I had to go to. And fortunately for me, it was one of the days when Peggy would open up her house to anyone. And you could just walk through and view the art and whatever you wanted to do while it was open. And I remember seeing her up on the porch with a very nice-looking young man. And nobody was talking to her. She was just sitting there quietly watching and observing. And I went up to her because I recognized her and said, "Miss Guggenheim, could I take a picture of you?" And she said, "Sure, you can take a picture, no problem." So I got this great picture, and I said, "Thanks very much for letting us come through." She said, "Anytime, come on back. We'd love to have you." So it was a memory that I still have, and that plus all the wonderful work that she had just propped up against the wall. She had these huge Jackson Pollock paintings just propped up against the wall. Wherever she had space, she filled it.
What a great story, Harris. Thank you so much for the call. Yeah. Here's some sound. Jane Turner Rylands, author of Venetian Stories, a friend of Peggy Guggenheim, describing her on the heels of Harris's call. This is good.
Peggy and I were very good friends. She was a very open, genuine person. She was completely without any guile. She had no hidden agenda. You could always assume that what she said was what she really meant.
Very open, generous, without guile, no hidden agenda. I mean, you talk about in the documentary, Lisa, about, well, she wasn't the most glamorous woman. And you noted in the documentary that art was sort of a mirror for her own strangeness. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think it's very true. First of all, she lived, once she decided to really transform her life, and she did this later in her life, you know, she really went forth with a lot of fortitude, and she did this on her own terms. You know, she was not, and this is quite amazing for a woman from that background to do. And what she, you know, she was believing in a set of individuals who were the underdogs. And this gave her this great sense of identity. And I think the identity with these artists really gave her this inner strength that she was looking for. Because, you know, what's quite incredible about Peggy is that, and, you know, you would see this in the movie, and you'll also see this in reading Francine's book, but, you know, she also had so much sadness in her life. Mm. And there was a lot to overcome. And you know, I think we forget about that. And, you know, she not only was rejecting this lifestyle that she did not want to be part of, but it's also this underlying sadness that was you know, would be hard for anybody to handle.
Mm. Here's some sound from art dealer Larry Gagosian from your documentary, Lisa, saying that Peggy Guggenheim was herself a work of art.
It doesn't surprise me that Peggy Guggenheim was regarded as a black sheep because she really did it on her own. She really was a self-made collector and kind of a self-made person in a broader sense. I mean, she was her greatest creation.
Her sadness, Francine Prose, contributed in large measure to her success, would you say?
Well, she had all these tragic events that happened to her from a very, very young age. I mean, the death of her father on the Titanic, and then her awful relationships with men, one after the other, and her feelings of inferiority, that she wasn't smart enough, educated enough, pretty enough. And then later, the death of her daughter, to whom she was very close. I mean, all these things added up, and there was a kind of tragic element to her personality, and yet this real spirit about living and wanting to live a good life and wanting to do something important and a kind of generosity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I heard Harris's story. I heard several stories like that when I was researching the book. I mean, the playwright John Guare tells a story about showing up at Peggy's palace in Venice with a few hours to spend in Venice, and a woman in a bathrobe answered and took him around, showed him the entire collection. And only at the very end did he realize that it was Peggy Guggenheim herself.
Let's go to Jimmy in Fredonia, New York. Hi, Jimmy. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I wanted to say that I am a huge lover of art in general. Modern art in general, like especially, is very important. But I do think that people use the term modern art as a guise to marginalize a lot of art that people in the general population don't understand. People will be so quick to say, like, oh, my child could do that, and saying it at a Jackson Pollock. And it'll be like, well, you don't understand, like, the contextual information, nor do I find that people who have that mentality want to learn and understand art. Mm. So it becomes disheartening as an artist in like this postmodern era that we live in, where people don't typically support the arts. Mm.
Jimmy, thank you. Thanks for the call. Here's Scott in Barrie, Vermont. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. The reason why people don't support the arts is because, unfortunately, modern art is the greatest farce ever perpetrated amongst humankind.
What is it but that you don't like about it, Scott?
There's no objectivity. It's distorted. It's complete distortion. So unfortunately, people don't support the arts because what is there to support? If it's all contextual, nobody understands anything. Hmm. So you can change the arts, that's fine, but it needs to have an objective quality. It needs to have a sense of realism and an ideal. Hmm. And if it doesn't have these things, then we're lost. We're lost as a society, as we are now, without the appreciation of ideals and objectivity, and this is why we live in such a snarky culture.
All right, Scott, thank you very much. Francine, Lisa, I'm sure you're both willing to respond and ready. Francine?
Well, you know, there's necessarily going to be differences of opinion about what people consider beautiful and important and so forth, but I also think that that one of the things about Peggy Guggenheim that was so extraordinary was how ahead of the curve she was. I mean, as I said before, the Louvre didn't think the art she had was art, was worth saving. And I think more people during her lifetime were inclined to think that their children could have done a Jackson Pollock than maybe are now. But the fact is that, Pollock's work is very beautiful, and she was very early to see that and to champion his work. I mean, she hired him to do a mural for her, the entrance to her apartment building, at a time when people would have just thought it was splashes of paint on the wall.
Lisa, tell us about her relationship with Jackson Pollock.
Well, it's an interesting. First of all, Francine gave a little bit of the background about Mondrian, saying that, you know, she really had to look twice at that work, and, you know, and she certainly did. And, you know, the person who played a very important role in Pollock's life at the time was also his wife. In the beginning, you know, they got married a little later, but it's Lee Krasner, and, you know, and she had a very, very strong personality, and she was also calling the shots from behind the scenes. But, you know, Peggy really gave Jackson, the Pollock, the opportunity for many different things by supporting him financially at a time that he wasn't, you know, that this just wasn't done before. And, you know, by giving him his first shows, he really started to think in a different way about art. And with this commission of the painting mural, which she had commissioned for her home, it also made him think in a different way about how big paintings were, because she gave him almost a precise dimension of, she said, "I want this for my entrance hall." Mm. And frankly, we don't know what Jackson Pollock would have been today if it hadn't been for the patronage of Peggy. And then what was so interesting was she, you know, part of her sharing art with the world was that she then donated many paintings to many different universities, including the University of Iowa, which now owns mural. But I was just up at RISD last week in Providence, and the first drip painting that he had ever done was there, and it was donated by Peggy Guggenheim. Mm. And, you know, it's really extraordinary that she had, you know, she did this all for the love of the art. And I think that's such a fundamental message, because especially what the art world is today, because it's become, it's such a manufactured landscape right now. And she was there in the very beginning and mm-hmm. believing in these artists. And I think it's a really important thing to remember.
Francine, how do you see it?
She loved her art, and she wanted to live among her paintings, which I think is, as Lisa said, unusual now. I mean, now it's more common that art collectors have advisors, and they buy paintings, and in many cases, the paintings go directly into storage. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would have been shocking, I think, to Peggy Guggenheim, who was so happy when she got to Venice, and as she kept describing it, was reunited with her painting. Mm-hmm.
Here's art historian Dori Ashton, lived in Venice, became a friend of Peggy Guggenheim's. Here she describes how their friendship was formed and what she saw in Peggy.
Peggy Guggenheim was a lonely lady. I sensed that, and I invited her to come for a simple meal. And she was so grateful, because nobody ever thought that they should invite the great Peggy Guggenheim just for a common, ordinary pasta dinner or something. I think that in many ways she didn't understand how much others tried to exploit her. And they did. They really did. And took advantage of her like mad, including artists. That's why I called her charmingly naive. Mm.
Francine, speak about that exploitation piece.
Well, she was, I mean, from very early on, she was always the one who was expected to pick up the check after everybody else's dinner, always, in Europe. And then criticized at the same time for counting up the bill the way, you know, many people might. So she had sort of, you know, she was sort of unfortunate both ways. I mean, she supported a tremendous number of people, her ex-husband Lawrence Vail, Juna Barnes, you know, all sorts of people, and at the same time was criticized for being stingy and mean.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the life and times of Peggy Guggenheim, heiress, art patron, outsider. You can join the conversation. What do you make of all that you've heard this hour? Do you think she deserves greater recognition? My guests are two women who were drawn to the story of Peggy Guggenheim, one who wrote a book and one who made a movie, trying to understand and to try to find the heart of this fascinating woman. Francine Prose is author of Peggy Guggenheim, The Shock of the Modern, and Lisa Imordino Vreeland is writer, director, and producer of the documentary Peggy Guggenheim, Art Addict. Here is some sound art dealer Arnie Glimcher and art historian John Richardson ponder Peggy Guggenheim's appeal as a woman.
I found her attractive. There was this extraordinary sense of self. There's something really beautiful about an older woman who knows who she is, who has a great accomplishment. That already is sexy.
I think Peggy had a very strange sort of form of sexiness. She didn't exude sexuality, but she had a kind of sexual aura that people did respond to. And she was a kind of a mixture of old-fashioned and very, very modern.
Peggy Guggenheim herself was very open about her romantic conquests, much to the shock of her family and others. Here from Lisa's documentary, you'll hear Guggenheim, writer and friend Nikki Haslam, and art historian Donald Cuspet on Peggy, sex, and art.
I liked intellectual men. I liked very tall, dark, good-looking men. But all my lovers certainly were not that.
The artists, she loved them because they were artists, not because they were sexy men. I mean, they actually were sexy men. I think sex and art went absolutely hand in hand in her brain.
She went for the bad boys, and it didn't do her any good.
Does it ever? She was a kind of a mixture of the old-fashioned, the very modern. Lisa, talk about that those contrasting pieces of her.
Well, you know, I think the fact that she grew up in such a traditional family, she had that aspect to her. So she was old-fashioned, but it was this breaking out and this finding freedom and independence that became, you know, this other side of her life that became very important. And it was also a way of getting to know herself. You know, unfortunately, in her history, you know, when one talks about Peggy, they often first talk about her sexual exploits, and that is where I feel is really the great misconception, because, you know, this was a way of her getting to know also the artists and these men that she was sleeping with. You know, they obviously found her interesting and dynamic, and it was just also a very contemporary way to look at life. And the differences, and Francine says it very well, because you may not know, but she is also a star in the film. You know, she was considered a slut for doing it, for living like that. And the truth is that there were many men and many women who were living like that. But the difference was that Peggy even wrote about it. And think of how free she was inside to write a book. She wrote an autobiography, Out of the Century, 1946 it came out. And she wrote all of the men she slept with down. Of course, she had used synonyms, but I mean pseudonyms, but she, of course, they were quite easily identifiable. Mm. And it was her message of femininity, of being a real woman and grabbing life and living on her own terms. And I think that's a big part of her story.
Francine, how do you see it?
Well, you know, when I was researching the book, several people said to me, well, she was very insecure about her appearance and this and that was why she took so many lovers. But I wound up thinking that wasn't the case. That my conclusion was she was a very, very brave woman, and brave in every way, brave in her collecting, brave in her life, brave in the way she lived, and taking all the lovers was part of the bravery. I mean, when you read her memoir, it's just astonishing the things she's willing to talk about. She talks about her abortions, for example, which people are hesitant to talk about even today, but she just felt that her life should be, so to speak, an open book, and she was extremely courageous about it.
Here's Ethan in Enterprise, Alabama. Ethan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Really enjoying the show. So it's been a real education. I guess the point I wanted to make is that as an avid follower of the arts, I think it's really interesting the way that Peggy lived her life, and promoting the arts. And to me, it's almost as if that is a work of art in itself. And even more so with modern art, which, you know, over history began to break down a lot of the typical ways art was viewed up until that point. This is just sort of another form of art to me, a way a person could live their life that may not be an actual sculptor or painter their self.
Mm. Ethan, thank you. Thank you so much. Here's Marilyn in Washburn, Wisconsin. Hi, Marilyn. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi. And I guess the way Ethan just phrased it, I would love to talk about a question regarding the actual Guggenheim Museum, because it is, you know, I think Frank Lloyd Wright designed it, but when you're inside the Guggenheim Museum in New York City, you are actually inside of a piece of art, the structure of the Guggenheim, and then you're looking at art from all different angles, the way the Guggenheim is designed. It basically, you just spiral down this, you know, start at the top or start at the bottom, but you are basically spiraling up around this this gallery, and you can have very close-up look at art, but also you, it's all open space across, and you can see the beautiful artwork all the way from a distance and very close. So I'm curious about, my question is, how did the Guggenheim Museum actually become, how was it built, and was Peggy involved in that?
Marilyn, thank you so much. Lisa?
You know what, so what had happened was that her uncle, Solomon Guggenheim, had already been collecting art, and he had very traditional collection with his wife that was housed at the Plaza, and there were Matisse's and there were Gauguins, but an interesting woman, an artist who was hired to paint the portrait of Solomon, Hilaire Bay, just then became an art advisor to Solomon, and he started to collect non-objective painting, and there was initially a first museum that was built in the late 30s, about the same time that Peggy had her own gallery in London called Guggenheim Jeun, and it was a museum of non-objective painting. And from that, that's where the next step for the formal Guggenheim Museum was really initiated, and Frank Lloyd Wright. And it was a process that happened because at that point, Solomon Guggenheim died, and Harry Guggenheim then took over. But it was the Guggenheim Museum was then opened later after the death of Solomon Guggenheim. And Peggy, you know, her big victory, because once she left New York, she really left very much the fold of the family. And when she showed in 1969 at the Guggenheim Museum, it was, you know, she really felt, you know, she made a big joke because, you know, she affectionately called the museum her uncle's garage because of the way it looked. And
actually, I have some sound from your documentary, Lisa, on that. Here she is, Peggy Guggenheim, talking about that. Funny for a person who could get modern art like that of Michel Duchamp. She was very not keen at all on her uncle's museum.
Oh, my uncle's garage, yes. But it looks like a garage, doesn't it? I mean, all that circular business is the way garages are built in Europe, on circular ramps.
Francine, talk about the reconciliation with the Solomon Guggenheim's part of the family and the bequeathing of her collection to them.
Well, Peggy spent the very last part of her life very concerned about what was going to happen to her legacy, and now the Guggenheim Foundation administers both. But you know, her uncle's parking garage, I have to say that I think it's a beautiful building, an extraordinary building, of course, but once you hear that, Uncle Solomon's parking garage, it's very hard to look at the museum and not just have that thought just flicker through your mind just briefly.
Here's Tom in Miami, Florida. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Well, during World War II, my mother-in-law and Peggy, whose husbands were in the Navy, they would go out and paint watercolors and sell it to the tourists. And in our dining room, there is an alleged Guggenheim watercolor.
That's fascinating. Who was your mother and father? I'm curious.
My mother-in-law was Blanche Costling, married to Henry Costling, who was stationed in the Navy in New Orleans. And Peggy had assumed a husband also in the Navy. And that's how they met.
Painted watercolors together.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
And painted watercolors together, Tom.
Yeah.
And fascinating.
To my knowledge, Blanche and her became very good friends during that period.
Tom, thank you. Thanks so much. Here's some more sound from your documentary. Peggy Guggenheim, of course, has been called a proto-feminist. I think they didn't think of herself as one, but lived as one. In this moment from your new documentary, Lisa, Lindsay Pollack, editor-in-chief of the journal Art in America, art historian Donald Cuspick, and Peggy herself. Here it is.
She just broke all the rules. There weren't that many precedents for women working, let alone working in the arts. It was a very male-dominated field.
It was my freedom, my liberation.
Peggy is a sort of model for the liberated woman, a very disturbed, liberated woman. She did what she wanted to do. She had the means to do it. But I think she really was in advance of her times.
Francine Prose, there's a bit of a conflicting picture of Peggy Guggenheim. On the one hand, she's a wonderful character, an original. She's got a great eye, did these very courageous things during World War II, does wonderful things for modern art generally. But previous biographers were often quite contemptuous, chalking her talent up as simply as luck, among other things. Why in the world did everybody give her such a hard time? Why these contrasting pictures?
Well, it's easy to think of dozens of reasons why someone might. I mean, she was a woman working in a field where men were traditionally in complete control. She had a very independent and some would say outrageous personal life. I mean, it could go on and on. I think at times she could be a difficult person, and she was known for the ability to be difficult. But everyone, she was a human being. I mean, everyone is a kind of mixed bag and has good and bad qualities, and she certainly had both, but she nonetheless was an extraordinary person and a great heroine, really.
Talk about her time in Venice, Lisa. At the end of her life, she was being courted by many museum curators who wanted her collection. What happened to it?
Well, you know what was interesting? When she arrived in Venice, you know, first of all, Venice is a very closed city. You know, there are a lot of towns in Italy that are like that, but Venice is especially that. And here she is, a divorced American woman with a collection of art that they really did not understand. And so it was very shocking for her to come in like that. And then she bought a palazzo on the Grand Canal and started to open it up to the public. And she became quite a star in that town, because in 1948, when the Biennale of Venice opened up, the Art Biennale of Venice opened up for the first time after World War II, she took over the Greek Pavilion. And there were lines every day to go in to see her collection. But it was very shocking art for that world at that time. But then she became a real destination. People would come. It would be not only Americans and museums that were visiting, but it would be this constant flow of people. And, you know, at the same time, her collection was also quietly traveling throughout different locations in Europe, and she was showing the collection. And, you know, she became a real destination point. But then also, which is very, very important, she set up the scene for this modern, the sense of this, of Venice becoming a city where modern art was shown, because at that point Gianni Agnelli would then buy Palazzo Grassi, and it really laid the stepping stone for Pinault to get involved with Punto della Dogana and to have the Fondazione Prada there by Mrs. Prada. And you know, this was once again something that she accomplished, and it all has to do with her tying in, being able to see this, that she had a vision of what she wanted to do with the collection, but leaving something, a great legacy for us to be able to be part of as well.
Here she is, Peggy Guggenheim, in late 1970s, talking about how she hated getting old, looking back on her life and missing her youth.
Everything used to be much more fun than it is nowadays.
Do you ever miss your turbulent days?
Yes, of course I miss them.
You wish you still had Max Ernst and Breton expounding?
No, I wish I were young enough to have lovers. I wouldn't want a Max Ernst in my life, my God, no.
It's horrible to get old. It's one of the worst things that can happen to you.
Francine Prose, what is Peggy Guggenheim's most lasting legacy beyond her incredible art collection?
Well, I think she's an inspirational figure. I think anyone, and I would say particularly any young woman who wants not exactly a model because her life was hardly a model life, but just encouragement that you can live the way you want to live, that you can have courage, that you can have nerve, that you can have a vision and carry it out. Her life, I think, is a perfect example. I mean, I think if I would encourage young women to see Lisa's film and read my book as just encouragement for a way to begin to think about living.
And Lisa, Peggy Guggenheim's place in the history of American art.
Oh, I think it's just beyond huge. And, you know, I think that Clement Greenberg said something that was really important. You know, he's convinced that her place in the history of American art will grow larger as time passes. And I think she's just proving that right now.
Lisa Immerdino-Vreeland is the writer, director, and producer of the documentary Peggy Guggenheim, Art Addict. It's opening tomorrow in New York and nationally next Friday. Lisa, so much. Great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you, Francine, as well.
Francine, great to have you. Francine is the author of Peggy Guggenheim, The Shock of the Modern. You can find an excerpt on our website, and I encourage you to read it. It's a fascinating story. Francine, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks very much.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks to you as well. This is On Point.